board is now in session. Please be seated.
Morning. You ready to proceed?
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm here on behalf of Kevin Moore this morning to argue on his appeal. And this involves a sentencing issue. And the issue presented in this court is simply one issue, I believe. It's whether or not an individual defendant may be sentenced in part based upon secret information. And respectfully, we would ask this court to answer that question in the negative. This court, as all courts do, favors deciding issues without reaching the constitutional questions, and I think that can be done in this particular case. If we take a look, as I have in my brief, at Superior Court Criminal Rule 32C3, the language in that rule is that of a mandatory disclosure of the pretrial services report. And in this case, what occurred was that the victim made a statement to the pre-sentence office. The statement was transcribed or summarized and was apparently presented to the sentencing judge. Certainly there was absolutely no knowledge of this statement being presented or what was in the statement to defense counsel or the defendant. While the pre-sentence report itself, the unsealed one, which this court ordered unsealed, indicates that it's for the judge's eyes only, the circumstantial facts of this case indicate that the prosecution had access to this particular portion of the report also. In addition, while the report itself...
Now, what's the basis for that conclusion?
Well, the basis for that conclusion is based on... The record basis for that conclusion, based on the record in this case, is one, the argument that the reason that this issue came up in the first place, the argument that the state was making in response to the defense original appeal. The defense original appeal was that the sentence was not based upon a minimal indicia of reliability. What the sentencing judge was referring to about prior conduct and all this, there was no record basis of that. The prosecution apparently knew about this statement made by the victim in this case. The prosecution's argument here on this appeal is that when the sentencing prosecutors at the trial court level was arguing to the court, she was indicating that there was prior abuse, and there were some statements about that. Certainly nothing near as specific as is set forth in the report itself. However, the state's argument on appeal is that that was a specific reference to this portion of the report coming from the victim. In addition, I don't know how the state would have even known to ask, well, let's go ahead and unseal this because there's additional information which is on the record and the sentencing judge considered, unless they knew about it. The defense even had no knowledge that this even existed in the first place. The state had to have known about that to even make the application to this court in the first place to go ahead and unseal that. And that's the record portions which I believe support the statement that the prosecution did have access to this.
Well, does the case turn on the fact that the prosecution had access, or isn't the case based upon the fact that the judge had information that the defense could not rebut and that the judge relied on that information in formulating the sentence?
That's absolutely right. I don't believe that's a crucial fact for your decision on the appeal, that simply one side had access and the other didn't. I believe that's exactly correct.
It's fair to say if the judge were to make a sentencing determination on information that the prosecution didn't have, and the prosecution was unhappy because they thought the sentence was too light, the prosecution would be standing where you are now complaining.
If they found out about the secret information, certainly, yes. And it's just fortuitous in this case that the prosecution made that. They're the ones who came before this court, knew about this, and that hopefully answers your Honor's question, that they came before this court and said, hey, there's additional information, and they're the ones who moved to unseal it. That wasn't the original basis for this appeal as to why the defendant took this appeal up to this court. Again, which is very fortuitous on his part that the prosecution went ahead and did that. And the other, I guess...
Could I interrupt for a second?
Certainly.
let's assume for the moment that it was improper, whether constitutionally or by virtue of the rule or whatever, for the trial judge to have considered this information. Even so, don't you, or on behalf of your client, don't you have to show us how this impropriety caused your client prejudice? Because I hear a lot about what was, I mean, I've read what was in that confidential portion, and certainly it's the kind of thing that I would think a judge would take into account, but how was your client in a position to rebut any of that? In fact, I haven't seen anything to suggest that there's anything inaccurate in those statements.
Well, because we were not able to make a record, because we knew nothing about it. And that's the reason why we had no opportunity to rebut.
But wait a second. No, see, that's where we're having a problem, because although the confidential portion was much more detailed, there was reference in the part that you did have access to that also talked about prior abuse. So if your client had some problem with even those general statements, why didn't your client make a record about how that's factually inaccurate?
Well, we didn't have a problem with the statements about the incident for which he was sentenced, which in fact my client, and we spoke about that sentencing, he was also pled guilty to a prior misdemeanor assault on the same victim, and we don't have any problem, we never had a problem with the judge going ahead and considering that. The issue of prejudice, one, I would argue in response to your question, that when secret information is applied like this, that there should be no burden whatsoever on the defendant to go ahead and prove prejudice as far as that influencing the judge. Having said that, the facts of this case, this is almost the perfect case for a defendant to bring this type of case up on appeal. It's egregious what was set, well, the difference between that information set forth in the victim statement and what's in the rest of the pre-sentence report. In the victim statement, you have allegations that someone's going to die, his next victim's going to die, I'm going to die, meaning the victim herself. Torture. I don't think I overstate the type of behavior when I call it torture. Suffocating the person, cutting off her clothing, urinating on her contacts, burning her eyelids with cigarettes. I don't know how any human being could read that, hear that those type of allegations, and not let that affect how they would view a person and sentence that particular person. So in this case, I would submit...
And I'm going to give 5 months.
Excuse me?
And I'm going to give 5 months.
I'm not going to comment upon whether the sentence, based on those facts, was excessive or not excessive, but the point is the defendant should have had the opportunity, maybe if the defendant had the opportunity to explain maybe these things that occur, and maybe he's a changed person from when these things happen, and here's why I'm a changed person, because X, Y, Z. Maybe these things didn't occur, and I've got 3 witnesses to say that she was going ahead and making these things up. Rule 32C3 specifically talks about when a defendant chooses to contest facts, he has the opportunity to go ahead and do so.
And all I'm asking is, are you prepared to represent to the court that your client has a basis to contest what's in the confidential portion of the record?
I don't know that I can answer that question. I have not sat down and prepared. We have not had to prepare for an evidentiary hearing on these things. I don't know how we would particularly go ahead and attack these things, either admitting or denying it. What's the opportunity of the defendant to go ahead and do that? We have no record whether I stand here and say, oh, these things never occurred, or that they occurred with explanation, and I can show you why my course has changed.
All right, maybe I should put it a different way. Let's assume that this court decides that there has to be a new sentencing, okay? And now you know about this portion of the record. Is anything different going to happen? Because if not, aren't we all wasting our time?
I absolutely do not believe that this court is wasting its time because it...
I
do acknowledge is certainly precious because certainly other litigants are waiting, and this is, I think this is a very important decision that has to be made,
okay,
not only for Mr. Moore's benefit,
but
for us.
Answer the question. You know, if we send it back, and now your client is fully aware of every portion of that report, is the proceeding that leads to the judge imposing a sentence going to be any different?
Yes. I guarantee that, yes, the proceeding will be different. Because those type of allegations somehow have to be addressed. I don't imagine I would stand there with a person prepared to be sentenced and not somehow address those type of allegations. Yes, certainly the proceeding would be different. If the question is...
Well, what you're saying to Justice Porter is, based on what I heard you say earlier, is they'll be addressed, but you don't know whether they'll be addressed by either A, yeah, I did all those things, or B, no, I didn't, and here are specific witnesses who will back me up, or C, just a denial with no further comment.
Yes, sir.
You just don't know the answer to that.
I don't know. That's exactly correct.
Okay.
I don't know, and I can't say how it would change, or if it would change the trial judge's actual decision.
What is the remedy you're asking for?
I'm asking for reversal of the sentence. I'm asking for a strong opinion from this court that any information to be considered by a sentencing...
A new sentencing judge? Same sentencing judge?
I don't see that there is a necessity of recusal of the sentencing judge based upon the record that I have seen in this case. The other point that I was attempting to make factually about this, again, the pre-sentence report refers to this was done with the permission of the sentencing judge, that the secret portion of the report. I have not seen an order. I have not seen a transcript reference. I have not seen an application in the record. I don't know what the standard would be. How did the trial judge decide what should be confidential information only disclosed to the court or to one side or another? There's no standards for that because there's nothing like that in the rules set forth.
Mr. Gill, at the risk of recreating some old ground, you can distinguish between arguing that the record before the court wasn't sufficient. There wasn't enough competent evidence to warrant the sentence that your client received, or the record was sufficient, but parts of it were not made available to you, which is a different issue. I gather it's the latter issue that we're dealing with, not the former, correct?
It's the latter. The government proved me dead wrong on my original appeal issue. That's correct. There was sufficient evidence there. But if you believe everything that's in there, in the victim's statement, yes.
Now, educate me on this. The judge will always has access, does he not, to the entire pre-sentence report?
Yes.
But not necessarily counsel?
Counsel has access to the entire pre-sentence report with the exception of the recommendation of the pre-sentence officer to the trial court. And that exception is expressly provided for by rule. The pre-sentence officer traditionally will make a recommendation.
So the victim statement would ordinarily be a portion that you would have an opportunity to see.
Absolutely. And in fact, 32C3 refers to, it doesn't limit to the portions that have to be disclosed to the defendant, but it refers higher up on the page to 32C2. It says that the portion that has to be shown to the defendant specifically includes, and it talks about the victim impact statement.
I would assume a fair position would be that should a judge, after reading the pre-sentence investigation, determine that there's a good policy reason why the judge should in camera examine a victim statement, whether it's for protection of the victim anxiety or whatever, that the defense and the prosecution would have noticed that that's what the judge is considering and be able to address whether an in camera review without access by counsel would nonetheless be fair to both sides. Would that be fair, even though the rule doesn't speak in those terms?
I would submit not. It was a fallback position as to where we could go on this, but
that's common in the criminal law, isn't it? Like revealing the identity of confidential informants, or whether or not a particular witness would be forced to take the stand. Aren't those kinds of in-camera review done as a matter of course, except there's notice to counsel about it, and there's an opportunity to object to it?
Well, except for very, very limited circumstances, which are provided for by statute or rules, such as in some cases, trial witnesses, and again, we've had limitation, greater limitations on that in the last few years.
I'm not when you're relying on the rule the way it's stated now, but I'm just going one step beyond that and suggesting, isn't there a way of balancing the interest of the parties and of a victim under circumstances like this, so long as everyone has notice and has a chance to speak to it?
I would submit not. Again, that's reaching the constitutional portion of this case. When we talk about Gardner, it just is violation of due process and unfair for a person to be sentenced upon allegations that are simply that they don't know about.
Right. So the problem here, as you've presented, is not that the state saw the secret portion and you didn't, but that you didn't see it, whether or not the state saw it. Is that right?
That's correct. That is correct. But again, I do believe that the record supports that the state had access to this.
Now, I have one other question. We generally suggest in our case law that as long as the sentence is within the range provided by statute, we don't get involved in appeals apart from some constitutional issue. Now you've raised the issue of, but what if the sentencing process violates a rule? In this particular case, let's assume for a moment that the trial judge had never seen the victim's statement. It was never made. Based on the facts apart from what was contained in the victim's statement, would the sentence have been justified?
It depends. Well, no, because, and that this would, if we remove the victim's statement here, and the trial judge makes the same exact findings and sentence that he made in this case, that would not have been justified, because even though this court certainly does not get involved in being a super sentencing court, arguing the substance within a guideline or not within a guideline, this court is always required, under due process principles, that there has to be some minimal indicia of reliability. So if the sentencing judge was sentencing on the basis of something which had no support upon the record, yes, I think this court should still go ahead.
All right, let me take the victim statement out of the equation. The bases that remain in the record on which the trial judge could have sentenced, we know it's within the statutory limit. Did it violate truth in sentencing guidelines?
No.
Okay. Then was the balance of the facts upon which he sentenced apart from the victim statement sufficiently documented in the record?
Yes, sir.
Well, then, where are we?
Because it's the consideration of those additional points and secrecy.
But if they weren't considered, he still could have just entered the same sentence, and it would have been supported by the facts and supported by the statutory framework and supported by truth in sentence guidelines, correct?
Agreed, yes.
But I assume your position is so with a lesser sentence or a greater sentence.
Yes. Yes. And again, we don't know where the judge would have ended up if that in fact occurred, and we didn't have that victim statement.
You're relying on our cases that say you can't rely on an improper factor, and do that having something known to the judge only that would be a basis for the sentence as an improper factor because it wasn't disclosed to the defense and the prosecution.
Yes, sir.
During your rebuttal time, do you want to save it or do you want to go on?
Unless there's any additional questions from the court, I don't have anything else additional there.
Excuse me, you want to save it?
I'll save it, yes, thank you.
Chief Justice, members of the court, may I please the court, let me just address a couple of the issues that were raised factually. I did speak with a prosecutor. She doesn't work in our office anymore, and she advised me that she did have a copy of the pre-sentence report, including the 2 pages of the victim's statement. So I think the record needs to be clear that the state did know about it in advance of the sentencing in this case. However, the state did not request that the victim's statement be made confidential. It appears that that was simply a unilateral decision by Judge Vaughn in this particular case. I don't think Judge Vaughn was the sentencing judge. The docket entries indicate it was Judge Vaughn.
I don't want to quibble, but how is it confidential if the prosecutor has it?
Well, I don't know. That's what it says.
It's quasi-confidential.
I guess it's confidential to one side and not confidential to the other side.
How do we find the reference in the record to Judge Varma's decision not to disclose it to the defense? Is there a docket entry, an order, a memo?
Not that I saw. The only thing that I saw was just a little notation at the top of, I think it's B12. Excuse me, I must be pointing back, B14 and 15. It B14. It just says, a victim requested that the following information be left out of pre-sentence report. This request was approved by the Honorable James T. Bowen, Jr., and that's the only thing I've seen in the record. It's at B14 of the state's appendix, but I don't know that there was ever any formal order.
And that's what the pre-sentence officer said?
Yes, that's in the pre-sentence report.
Then how did it end up in the hands of the prosecution?
Well, I think what happens is they let the parties review the pre-sentence report. In this case, the trial prosecutor advised me she was given a copy of the pre-sentence report, and she had it, and in that copy of the pre-sentence report was the victim's statement.
Now, I understand, but I'm trying to understand how, if the pre-sentence officer says the judge said it was to remain confidential, how does the pre-sentence officer give it to the state but not to the defense?
Well, I don't know, but that's what she did. You know, assuming it's
all parties on this farm are equal, but for some who are more equal than others.
Well, it sounds like Animal Farm, yes. That, and I think those are the facts here. But and the key, of, I believe, for this appeal, however, is deciding one, the propriety of that. It's certainly not authorized by the rule. Nonetheless, as has already been mentioned today, there may be extraordinary circumstances where a judge may wish to make a portion of a pre-sentence investigation confidential. A prime example would be an application by the state under Delaware Rule of Evidence 509 to protect confidentiality of informants. That's a usual circumstance where something like this might arise. And the state certainly agrees that the proper way to handle this would be upon prior notice to both parties. That was not done in this case, certainly not in prior notice to the defense, to Mr. Moore.
It's unlikely that the identity of an informant, whether or not that was disclosed, would affect how long a jail sentence might be, whereas facts from the victim certainly could.
Oh, I agree. I think that that's probably true. You know, it just is speculation about what an informant might or may not say, but that's a circumstance that's authorized by a rule of evidence where a judge might say, well, okay, we're going to keep that portion confidential, and there's other compelling reasons for doing that.
This may be clear, and perhaps I just don't remember, but there was no reason for the pre-sentence officer to believe that this was a statement to the victim that had been taken by the prosecutor, and therefore the prosecutor would already know the content. This is a statement that was given to the pre-sentence officer?
Yes. I think it was part of the victim impact investigation that the statute, the victim impact statute.
So it's something the state wasn't otherwise privy to?
No, we didn't know about it till the prosecutor got the report, and then in the report was this two-page statement by the victim interview. Where I became involved in this was certainly the appeal was filed. The initial issues raised on appeal was that there was insufficient evidence to support the judge's finding of two aggravating circumstances, prior domestic violence involving the same victim, and the fact that the assault victim's two minor children were present and were witnesses during the assault. That was the initial argument on appeal, and it's, I understand today that it's being conceded that given all of the evidence in the pre-sentence report, including the victim's two-page statement, that there was sufficient evidence. The question now is, and I think it's already been raised by this court as well, how was Mr. Moore ultimately prejudiced?
Well, before we get to that, as I understand the state's position, it would acknowledge that the victim has a right to speak and be heard by the sentencing judge, and that the defendant has a right to know what the victim communicates to the sentencing judge, unless there's some extraordinary reason for not letting it be known, but the defendant gets notice that the judge is going to consider that.
Yes, I think that's appropriate. I mean, originally, pre-sentence reports, pre-sentence investigations were confidential, and there's an old 1954 Superior Court decision by Judge Herman that I cited that originally the defense didn't get to see pre-sentence report at all, but that looks like it's been superseded by the Superior Court criminal rule, and the Rule 32 doesn't make any provision, any explicit provision anyway, for making portions of the pre-sentence investigation confidential, that one side or both sides is not allowed to see that, with the exception of the recommendation from the pre-sentence officer, and neither side gets to see that.
In this case, then everyone agrees this was not the proper procedure. And the question then becomes, since the judge had information that the defendant didn't have, and the defendant never had an opportunity to comment on it, does it make any difference anyway?
Yes, I think that's the crux issue as it exists now, and the state's position is that ultimately the defendant was not prejudiced, even though he did not have access to this two-page victim report. There are other explicit references in the pre-sentence investigation that Mr. Ward and his attorney did have access to that go and address the same two claims that were raised, that is, prior domestic violence involving the same victim, the same defendant, and that the victim's two minor children were witnesses. Those statements exist in the pre-sentence investigation, certainly could have been addressed at sentencing. The only thing that Mr. Moore didn't know was exactly what the victim said to the pre-sentence investigator. So in this case, I don't...
If we were doing like a harmless error analysis, you're very familiar with that, the Chapman standard that we've adopted, where you say, we're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that, notwithstanding this problem, it didn't have absolutely any effect on the outcome. And what Mr. Gill tells us is that not in the report were some fairly significant antisocial behavior. And you're saying the fact that the victim said this person, you know, was potentially violent to the point of being homicidal, that had inflicted conduct that might be construed as torture, and these other things just would not have been a factor in the sentencing judge's mind.
Well, I don't know if they would have been a factor, but I don't know that they ultimately affected the result here. The sentencing guidelines call for this class D felony, I believe, a sentence of up to 2 years, level 5 incarceration. The plea agreement, whereby the other four charges were nulli-prost and he pled guilty to the second-degree assault, was that the state would cap its sentencing recommendation at 6 months. Ultimately, Mr. Moore received 5 months of level 5 incarceration, followed by 6 months of level 4 home confinement, and then 18 months of probation, level 3 probation. And he was sentenced at the beginning of November last year, so he should by now have completed the level 5 and the level 4 time, and he's into his level 3 probationary period at this point, if there is a resentencing. But
doesn't the fact that it's necessary to provide secret information suggest a level of dangerousness in and of itself that can be prejudicial?
Well, I don't know. That's a subjective, I guess, judgment made by the victim in this case, and it was apparently her request that her statement be kept confidential. So looking at it from purely her subjective viewpoint, I guess the answer to that is yes. More objectively, I don't know that that's true. Mr. Moore knows, because he's going to jail, that this has been reported, and he already understands that she's the one who's made the allegation. The only people who were present in the home when all this occurred was the victim, her two minor children, and Mr. Moore. So it wasn't any big secret as to who his accuser was or what was being asserted here. So I think in a broader objective framework, Mr. Moore would certainly know what was going on here, that there wasn't any secret about who the accuser was. And the only difference or difficulty here is he didn't know the specifics of exactly what she told the pre-sentence investigator. And admittedly, it is more detailed than the rest of the pre-sentence report. It's her personal recollection, but looking at the remainder of the report that was available to Mr. Moore, there was certainly sufficient evidence for the trial judge to find the two aggravating factors that he did find among the other aggravating factors in this case, that is, prior domestic violence involving the same victim and the presence of the victim's two minor children. None of that would change. And I think because of that, there ultimately isn't any demonstrable prejudice in this particular case, even though what happened shouldn't have happened, that if there was going to be a confidential portion of the pre-sentence report, at least both sides should have been given prior notice, or the defense should have been put on some kind of notice that there's something out there that you really don't know about.
Mr. Williams, if I understand it correctly, the sentence is within the statutory limits. It's within the truth in sentencing guidelines. The state at the plea agreement capped its recommendation for sentence at 6 months, correct, level five. The defendant got 5 months at level five, less than the state requested. And given the track record and, let's be realistic, and reputation of the sentencing judge, was there any realistic expectation on the defendant's part that he would get a lesser sentence than 5 months?
Well, I don't know. I think his hope was, and the argument made at sentencing, was that he should only get level four home confinement time. He was hoping to get no level five jail time. But the record that was known, I mean, disclosed that he already had an assault third conviction in the family court in Newcastle County involving the same victim, that, you know, there was a prior conviction. There were some other charges that had been made in the past, but those had ultimately been nulliprost. But nonetheless, he already had one domestic violence conviction on his criminal record. So I think while he may have hoped for level four, a level four commitment in this particular case, that the chances of actually receiving that were probably fairly slim. The victim did sustain some fairly serious physical injuries. She had four stitches by her eye orbit. The bones around her eye were damaged, and that was going to necessitate plastic surgery. And she had a drooping eyelid as a result of the injury to her eye, and that was going to require subsequent surgery down the road. So, you know, there were substantial physical injuries here, and given that and the prior criminal record involving the same victim, that most likely he was going to receive a sentence of incarceration of some amount. He could have received 8 years under the statute. It's a Class D felony. The sentencing guidelines call for 2 years, and as Your Honor has pointed out, he actually received a sentence less than the state's recommendation, or state's cap, anyway.
Okay, so are you suggesting then that the sentencing judge discounted or did not find credible the statements of the victim?
I don't think so.
Aspects of torture would seem to take this out of the routine domestic violence case.
Well, that could be. I mean, it's hard to examine these sentences after the fact, and sometimes trying to compare one sentence to another sentence, it's sort of like comparing apples and oranges. But I think the judge certainly had a concept of what was going on here. The difficulty, I guess, is that these domestic violence cases are always problematic. Sometimes you have extremely uncooperative victims. They don't show up for the trials, and charges end up being dismissed, and then later on a more serious incident happens and the same parties are back in court again. So I don't know what ultimately went into the judge's findings here, but you know, that was the sentence he received. I don't think under the facts that were certainly disclosed in the pre-sentence investigation available to Mr. Moore, that was an unjustified sentence in any respect. And given that, ultimately Mr. Moore can't show any demonstrable prejudice in this particular case.
If we reverse this sentencing or vacate the sentencing and remand for a new sentencing, what is the sentencing range available to the judge? Is it 0 to 8?
Well, I'm not sure. There is some law out there that you can't receive a sentence that's more excessive than the original sentence imposed after a reversal unless the judge finds additional factors. So I don't know that it's, I guess the statutory range is certainly 0 to 8. That's what the statute says. Ultimately, could Mr. Moore receive a more substantial sentence? I think it would require the sentencing judge at a minimum to find some additional factor that was not articulated at the original sentence. And since Mr. Moore should be into his level 3 probationary period at this time, I'm not sure what his ultimate remedy might be, even if he was successful in obtaining a new sentence, if the judge would say that he needs a lesser period of probation or not. I don't know. Maybe that's the best he could hope for as a result in this particular instance.
So he's already served his 5 months.
He served his 5 months, and he should have served his 6 months home confinement. He was sentenced on November 1st of 2004, and we're 11 months plus past that. We're now into October of 2005, so he should be into his level 3 probation, unless there's been some problem with, you know, his serving the other sentence. But looking at it simply on a calendar basis, he should have completed all of the level 4 and the level 5 time, and all that remains is the 18 months of the level 3 probation. If there's any additional questions.
Well, we do have a matter under advisement concerning mootness, and the one exception to the mootness doctrine is that if it's capable of being repeated but yet evading review. So what's your position with regard to whether this is moot or not?
Well, I thought about whether it was moot or not, and I assumed it wasn't moot simply because he has the 18 months of level 3 probation, and I think as long as there's any portion of the sentence that's still outstanding that hasn't been served, that it's not moot on that basis. And whether it's a question of evading review or not, I don't know. This is certainly an anomalous circumstance. I mean, I was never aware that portions of pre-sentence reports were confidential other than the recommendation, which the rule specifically provides for. So that was all news to me when I found out that there was this two-page victim statement. I wanted it unsealed because the arguments being made on appeal was that there was insufficient evidence, and this was a guilty plea. There wasn't any trial. The victim did not appear at sentencing. The defendant spoke just very briefly at sentencing, so there wasn't a whole lot of a record as to what it was the judge relied upon apart from the pre-sentence investigation, and that's why I had requested that it be unsealed, so this court would have an appellate record to review. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
To attempt to answer this mootness, although I haven't fully researched that, he does have 7 years and 7 months of level 5 time still suspended should he have a violation of probation. So on top of the probationary sentence, which is a restriction on liberties, obviously, which he has to serve, we submit that there are real consequences for Mr. Moore in this case. As regards to the proof in the record of the trial judge actually considering this evidence, he doesn't make specific factual reference, but he does specifically talk about prior abuse and prior abuse that was not charged, which to me distinguishes it from the earlier assault, the misdemeanor assault, which we did know about and which certainly was proper for the trial judge to go ahead and consider.
And what sentence do you think could be imposed if you're successful in this appeal?
Well, the cases which I believe Mr. Williams is referring to, you cannot retaliate for taking an appeal or getting a case reversed, and we would not expect the trial judge to go ahead and give a retaliatory greater sentence simply because this appeal was taken and the sentence was reversed. I would, unless there was something else about Mr. Moore, and certainly I think the trial court could examine Mr. Moore's behavior. What did he do when he was in prison? What has he done on home confinement? What has he done on probation? Is he out drinking? Is he done other problems? I think it probably would be appropriate for the trial judge to consider post-sentence behavior, both for positive and negative, as to whether the sentence should have been greater or lesser. Obviously, he can't do anything about the 5 months incarceration or the home confinement time, which has already been served. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Take the case under advisement.
Please rise.